From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. She was the queen of Creole and a friend to civil rights leaders and presidents. At her funeral this Monday, a noted restaurateur said, "I don't know if God realizes he's about to gain 20 pounds.
Everyone sees the picture of Obama because she chastised him like a grandmother. Don't be putting no hot sauce in my food before you taste it." But she also talked about George Bush and her friendship they had. She hoped and believed that it was possible for us to get along and work together.
Leah Chase passed away earlier this month at the age of 96. She was the matriarch of Dookie Chase, a New Orleans institution that has withstood the Jim Crow era and Hurricane Katrina. I wanted to take a closer look at her life and legacy, and for that, I'm joined by author and filmmaker Lolis Eric Eli. You're from New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about Dookie Chase and how it figured into your family celebrations and overall sense of community.
My parents went to Dookie Chase when my father graduated from law school. It was the place to go for black people during segregation who wanted a sense of something fabulous or something special. And mind you, that is not how that restaurant started. Dookie Chase's family started sort of a sandwich shop, and it was not a real restaurant in a lot of ways. Well, then he married this woman who was 3 or 4 years older than him, Leah Lang. She came into the business, but she had worked at a couple of French Quarter restaurants and had a vision of something grander. And over time, you can imagine the kind of fights this upstart woman would have with her in-laws, but over time, they transformed it into a beautiful place. And mind you, all the big entertainers would come there, you know, Ray Charles, Duke Ellington, Lena Horne, those folks would come and they'd eat at Dookie Chase. It was also back in the days when there were a lot of late night happenings as well. So folks would go there often after hanging out all night. Yeah.
What I love about how the restaurant is described is that there's this, the main restaurant, the dining room, which is something special. And then there's a takeout window, which often serves a different population who is very vocal.
Yeah, well, you got to realize that Dookie Chase is in the middle of Faubourg Tremé, but also, until relatively recently, was across the street from the Lafitte Public Housing Projects. So mind you, the restaurant also predates the public housing projects, but you're talking about folks who certainly are not going to go to Dookie Chase every day, but who are going to eat every day. And so they would go and get sandwiches and a plate of red beans and such from the takeout window. And Ms. Chase was proud of the fact that she had a good relationship with those folks, despite the fact that politicians and entrepreneurs and musicians would come to a restaurant. She loved the fact that also folks from that public housing development would eat there and enjoy the food and feel that it addressed their nutritional needs as well.
Give us a sense of the kind of food she made and how it evolved over time.
Well, there is something of a canon of New Orleans restaurants, and Leah Chase was very proudly Creole. So there was red beans and rice, there was fried chicken, there was fried catfish, and she, unlike most folks, even after getting catfish fillets was pretty simple, she would serve whole catfish fried. But the other thing is that you have sort of the Creole haute cuisine, stuff that you wouldn't have every day, but you'd have it on holidays or special occasions. So gumbo, or she'd make these soups. I remember crab and cauliflower soup she made one time that I liked a lot. And something I had first at Leah Chase's restaurant that is now on a lot of New Orleans menus, and that's white beans and shrimp. And these are two things that we eat a lot of in New Orleans, but I hadn't heard them put together before until she did it. And also, to really understand Leah Chase's cooking, you'd have to either go there on a special occasion or go to an event that she'd catered. So I remember one time she made stewed cajun or stewed turtle. So everybody, I'm at the table with a bunch of chefs, Joe Randall out of Savannah, Georgia, and a bunch of other folks. We're trying to figure out what this is because, as they say, it tastes like chicken, but these are some weird bones in this chicken. Well, it turned out it was stewed turtle. And so I loved it. I'd never had that before. It's one of those things that, like much of what Leah Chase would do, was stuff that she'd grown up on eating, and it was not something that was common in New Orleans at that point. She said that she'd make me a stewed cajun, but I'd have to bring the turtle in live, or at least have the turtle come in with feet on it. Because if you don't see the feet on a turtle, you don't know what kind of animal it is somebody's trying to bring in and pawn off his turtle.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, there was a time, particularly at the turn of the 20th century, where a turtle was both something that people foraged for and lived off of, and was in like super haute cuisine all over the country.
Well, part of what she did was take those country recipes that folks had kind of forgotten in the city, except for the fine dining chefs, and she started putting them on her menu, at least on her specials. I remember I interviewed her once for First We Feast. She talks about purslane, which I knew little or nothing about, but it was something that they would forage back in the day. Or another thing she liked, especially when she made the gumbo zerb on Holy Thursday before Easter, was peppergrass. And she would find it on a neutral ground, because most of us would be like, man, if I see some stuff in the middle of the sidewalk, I'm too scared, it's poisonous, I'm not going to touch it. But if you grew up in Madisonville, Louisiana, grew up poor, grew up with a lot of children, I forget the number, but I think she's one of nine brothers and sisters or some number like that, a whole lot of things you got to do to survive. But as we got to the point where fewer of us knew these things, fewer of us even had gardens, fewer of us were foraging, we forgot these things and it became sort of gourmet specialties. Leah Chase helped reintroduce urban, sophisticated New Orleans to that kind of country Creole cooking.
You know, I just feel like New Orleans went through like triple punches, and so many people were writing eulogies for the city. It was never going to come back. What was her role after Katrina?
Well, it was a dual role. She both helped rebuild it and was helped by the spirit of the city in rebuilding what she did. The group of women in New Orleans who called themselves Women of the Storm, they had a very simple mission, which made it a lot easier for it to be bipartisan and broad and multiracial. They went to Washington and simply tried to tell senators and congressmen to come to New Orleans and see what had happened, or come to the Gulf Coast. What a lot of people don't quite understand is that Hurricane Katrina did not destroy New Orleans. It was a failure of the federal levees. Parts of Mississippi were destroyed by Katrina, and those places were flattened. New Orleans was not flattened. It was inundated by water. What we were trying to say to these people is, if you come and see the damage, and especially if you imagine what, if you understand what the Corps of Engineers' role was in the destruction of New Orleans, then you would help us. So in that sense, she was an ambassador, but also a group of people, including Poppy Tooker, who's a food writer and radio personality in Louisiana. We got together and said, how can we bring Dookie Chase back? Jeff John Fulce knew that Leah Chase had gumbo zerb on the Holy Thursday before Easter, and that was a big time for people to come back. So Muriel's Restaurant agreed to host the Holy Thursday, and John Fulce agreed to cook the gumbo zerb in his kitchen, and that was a fundraiser for Dookie Chase. So Ms. Chase used a quip that she couldn't die because she owed too many people too much stuff. And it was a beautiful sentiment coming from a woman who was at that point in her 80s and at that point as determined as any of us to come back. But we think about the Book of Paradise Built in Hell, about the kind of cooperation that people, even in these dire circumstances, bring to the table. That is what Leah Chase benefited from. But then, of course, we all benefited from the fact that the restaurant reopened and its art collection was still intact despite the flood.
So what happens now? Is any of the family involved in the restaurant? Are they going to be leading it forward?
What's been striking and heartening is the fact that even though all of the Chase children, children of Leah Chase, went to college, got their degrees, became teachers, professors, and a great singer, they also have been helping out with the restaurant. And perhaps more importantly, her grandson, Dookie Chase the third, is a trained chef. He has his own restaurant at the airport in New Orleans, but has been helping out. The other thing I would need to say is that Leah Chase had a niece, Cleo, who was her main cook for the last 20 or more years. Cleo is still there. There are pictures on Instagram of people eating at Leah Chase's restaurant the day after her funeral. So I'm happy about the prospects of it moving forward into another generation of the Chase family and maintaining those traditions.
Thank you so much, Lois.
Evan, thanks for having me, especially to talk about the great Leah Chase.
That's filmmaker and food historian Lois Eric Eli. We've been remembering Leah Chase, who died earlier this month at the age of 96. After the break, we're taking a trip up Highway 59 to Possum Trot, Alabama. I'm talking with Pulitzer Prize-winning author Rick Bragg about his mom's Southern Table. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
We're back on KCRW's Good Food. I'm Evan Kleiman. Oftentimes on Good Food, we talk about the virtues of a home-cooked meal. But when it comes to a mother's cooking, well, really nothing compares, does it?
Since she was 11 years old, even if all she had to work with was neck bones, pepper grass, or poke salad, she put good food on the plate. She cooked for dead broke uncles, hungover brothers, shade tree mechanics, faith healers, die shooters, hairdressers, pipe fitters, crop dusters, high steel walkers, and well diggers. She cooked for iron workers, Avon ladies, highway patrolmen, sweatshop seamstresses, fortune tellers, coal haulers, dirt track daredevils, and dime store girls. She cooked in her first 80 years more than 70,000 meals, as basic as hot butter biscuits with pear preserves or muscadine jelly, as exotic as tender braised beef stripe and white milk gravy, in kitchens where the only ventilation was the banging of the screen door.
That's Pulitzer Prize-winning author Rick Bragg. He's written a powerful memoir about his upbringing in Possum Trot, Alabama, a childhood that revolved around his mother's Southern cooking. It's called The Best Cook in the World, Tales from My Mama's Table.
This book is so, so much. It's quite wonderful. So this woman, your mom, Margaret Marie Bundrum Bragg, did she consider herself the best cook in her world?
She didn't even like the title. She told me, "What would you even call a book like that?" And I told her, you know, we'd call it The Best Cook in the World. And she said, "Well, I wasn't even the best cook on our road. My mama was a good cook. My sister was a good cook." But I told her that, you know, calling it the third best cook on the Roy Webb Road didn't really sing. So, no, she didn't think much of the idea at first.
So your mother was able to actually read this book?
Oh, yeah. Her eyesight has faded quite a bit. So I read it to her. And, of course, the advantage to that is if you get to a part you think she won't like, you can just skip it.
You have been writing for so long. What was it that moved you to take on this project to write about your mom's cooking and the world that it encapsulates?
Well, she got sick. She had a terrible bout with cancer, and, you know, I thought we might lose her. And since I'm the only one of my family that doesn't have a real job, I am the one who, you know, gets the overnight shift in the hospital. And I also had the job of bringing her clothes from home, and because she wouldn't dare be caught dead in a hospital gown. The doctors had to treat her through a full set of clothes, including her white orthopedic shoes and a turtleneck. I would go get her fresh clothes, and I walked into the kitchen one day, and it just struck me that it was wrong. The kitchen that usually smelled like pinto beans and ham and beef short ribs and, you know, fresh cut cantaloupe just smelled like dishwashing detergent and kind of old iron. And it occurred to me that I wanted to know where the true best cook in the world got her food. Thankfully, she recovered, but we spent 2 or 3 years kind of knee-to-knee just talking about the food, and that led to where it came from. Because if you don't have the math, if you don't have cups and ounces and tablespoons, if you don't cook like that, then you have to cook with the memory of the people who taught you, and that always had a story. always had a story. And that's when I thought, you know, we might have a book here.
One of the things reading just even those first few pages and then realizing that in your mom's day when she started cooking, you didn't just go to a refrigerator and open it up and take out your ingredients. You didn't just go to the stove and flip a button or turn a switch. You had to make fire. You had to make butter if you wanted to use butter.
Oh, absolutely.
What was her life like?
Well, if you think that she was born in 37 in the teeth of the Great Depression, the first truth in this book is that you cannot enjoy a good meal just because it was stolen. There was chicken thieving and hog thieving and one cow theft. My people, they were survivors. And, you know, you chop the wood to build a fire, and if you wanted chicken, you had to go out and commit murder. You know, just the very story of how you choose. My great-grandfather telling my grandmother how you pick a chicken, how you sneak up on them, because your chickens think everything that happens is the end of the world. So it's harder than you think. So if you have to run down a meal before you can actually cook it and eat it, maybe there's a little more import to it. And that was the world that my mom grew up in.
As you've moved through the world, you've had the opportunity to indulge in a lot of different cuisine. And your preference is always working class, blue-collar food. What do you think makes these most simple and humble dishes the most delicious?
Well, I think it is imagination. In the Caribbean, whoever came up with, you know, fried or grilled grouper and rice and peas and fried sweet plantains, I'd really like to shake their hand. And that's just a version of the dishes that my people grew up on. Not necessarily a lot of pork, but enough pork to season. A lot of beans. The onion is a principal way to season. A lot of potatoes. But also a lot of greens. Collard greens, turnip greens. And, you know, some things that just grew wild. I just think it tastes better. Don't get me wrong. I love to go in a fancy restaurant and see what the rich folks are doing. But the fact is, I'd rather have a biscuit. I'd rather have what my mother calls butter rolls, which are a sweet dumpling for dessert, than creme brulee. I'd rather have chicken and dressing than just about anything.
You are not alone in these preferences, I must say. Talk to us about your mother and your grandmother's thoughts on pie, on meringue, and reconciliation.
Well, meringue was just tarting it up. You know, there just wasn't any point in tarting up a good pie. It didn't really have much flavor, and it just tarted up and ruined a perfectly good pie. It was perfume on a hog. There was just no point in it. And I believe in that. I believe that, you know, the richness of a good chocolate pie or a coconut pie, it doesn't need anything else. It was a way to make peace with neighbors that you were feuding with. There was an old man who lived across the gully from them named Reardon, who also made whiskey. My grandfather made a little whiskey. And they were at war. My grandmother, to make peace, would take the old man, the patriarch, who was in a wheelchair. She would send pies by her two oldest boys, which would have been a good idea if they had not eaten them the minute that they got out of sight. And the pies never made it, and peace never really came.
Listening to this context in which your mother grew up and how she cooked, which was just so much an expression of her and her center, how were you able to translate this cooking to recipes?
Oh, people have asked me, what test kitchen did you use? And I always said, look at me. I'm 6'2". I weigh 250 pounds. I am a test kitchen. The math was impossible. It was almost impossible, especially for a non-cook. And, you know, when you ask your mother, how many cups? Well, I don't know. And when you do, when you hold her feet to the fire and you say, I have to know how many cups, she doesn't think of cups as a measuring cup. She thinks of cups as a chipped old ceramic, you know, that you drink coffee out of. I would ask her to be more specific, and she'd say, Well, you know, hon, just put some. Well, what in the heck is some? What mathematical caliber do you use for some? So instead, you got stories. You know, chicken and dressing, you take that spoon and you poke it into the top of that dressing, and it's just golden brown and creamy underneath with big chunks of chicken. And you ask your mom, where does this come from? How do you make this? And instead of saying, well, you do this, you do this, and you do that, she would tell me the story of the time that her cousin Sis, who was the very best chicken and dressing cook in the world, shot her husband in the teeth. She would go into the story of how that came to be and how the man didn't die, but it sure didn't do his teeth any good. And only after the story, and sometimes after days, you know, you would say, but what does that have to do with chicken and dressing? And she said, well, you know, the gun she used to shoot Carter was the same gun that she used to murder Ike. And only after a couple more days, or sometimes just a few hours, do you find out that Ike was a chicken. And Ike became chicken and dressing. And that is where the whole dang roundabout thing comes from. But we did have recipes. I think there's 70-something recipes in here. And they are all as near as I can get. But believe me, sitting there with that old woman trying to get her to kind of quantify heart and soul, it was the hardest thing I've ever done in a book. And I've done some pretty grim, sad books. Yeah, but we got it done. And so far, no one's called in to say that I caused them great, like, abdominal distress.
And we should say the book is not grim. There is so much joy in this book.
No, and that was another reason to do it. It was a happier chance to sit and talk to my people. I asked her in the end if she was happy with the book. And my people are very funny. They love the stories. They told me the stories, but mostly they just wanted to make sure I used the right pictures.
Well, thank you so much.
Oh, listen, anytime. It's my pleasure.
That's Rick Bragg. We've been talking about his book, The Best Cook in the World, Tales from My Mama's Table, out now. Summer's arrived in L.A., so we're turning our attention to some liquid refreshment. After the break, the origins of tiki bars. Stick around. Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. Los Angeles is home to movies, make-believe, and the tiki bar. Yes, those kitschy tropical taverns serving Mai Tais and poo-poo platters in the 1950s and 1960s were born in L.A. Paola Mardo recently dove deep into the history and origins of tiki bars for Long Distance, her podcast about the Filipino diaspora. We're sharing a shorter version of her story here, which begins at the legendary Tiki Tea.
There's an old bar in Los Angeles on Sunset Boulevard just east of Hollywood. From the outside, it looks like just another hole-in-the-wall dive, except for a few things. Tropical knickknacks hanging from the ceiling, patrons in Hawaiian shirts holding funny-shaped mugs, and a big sign above the front door that spells the bar's name, Tiki Tea. Next to it, the head of a wooden tiki, the icon for the ever-popular Tiki Bar. Inside, customers sip on colorful cocktails like the Mai Tai and the Zombie. I asked them what it is that brought them here in the first place.
So you walk into a tiki bar and it's not like any other bar. And the people that are there are usually there because they want to have fun and they want to enjoy some tropical drinks and they want a little escape.
It reminds me of being somewhere warm and tropical.
It's just kind of like old school Americana.
I like the island theme. I'm Filipino, so I'm kind of biased.
I like that there's weird stuff everywhere. All these guys have on Hawaiian shirts.
Do you go to tiki bars a lot?
I do. This is my second time here this week.
Oh, wow. What is it about tiki bars that you like?
I think Don the Beachcomber said that if you can't go to paradise, I'll bring paradise to you. And that's sort of how I feel about it.
These folks find a little bit of paradise at the Tiki Tea. It's one of the oldest tiki bars in Los Angeles, and it's still owned by the same family that opened it back in 1961. Mike Buchan is the snow-haired man in the Hawaiian shirt usually smoking a cigar while checking IDs up front.
We're drinking at Ground Zero. You know, we got a legacy that goes way back.
Mike's dad is Ray Buchan. Ray worked his way up through different tiki bars, mixing drinks for Hollywood celebrities and Angelenos for decades. Ray moved to Los Angeles from the Philippines in 1930. As far as I know, he didn't set out to be a tiki bartender, but by the time he opened up his own tiki bar, the Tiki Tea, he was a legend in the Los Angeles tiki scene. We're going to come back to the story of Ray Buchan later in this episode. First, we need to talk about the history of tiki bars. The very first tiki bar was called Don the Beachcomber, a nautical-themed bar that opened in Hollywood in 1934, 1 year after the repeal of Prohibition. Its founder was a man who went by the name of Don Beach. Don was a character. He loved to party and to travel. He decorated his bar with souvenirs from his many trips to Hawaii and other Polynesian islands. He also rented them to film productions, becoming an advisor for movies set in the South Seas, which were very popular at the time. A little crazy considering the fact that he wasn't a historian and had no real connections to Hawaii or the Pacific. Regardless of Don's qualifications, his bar attracted Hollywood coworkers and celebrity guests like Charlie Chaplin, Marlena Dietrich, and Howard Hughes. Soon, other tiki bar chains started opening up across the country, like Trader Vic's, where the Mai Tai was invented.
And what I learned about tiki bars was that they really arose after World War II, after servicemen came back from the Pacific.
That's Karen Williams, a Cook Islander film producer who works at the New Zealand Film Commission. Years ago, she worked on a film called American Tiki.
Obviously, they'd been in the war, and that had been horrible, but they'd also had these great experiences on the beach, at the luau, with the hula girls, and they were sort of trying to recreate that in their own world.
By the time Hawaii became the 50th state in 1959, tiki bars expanded into Polynesian-style lounges and restaurants. By the 1960s, tiki culture was so popular that it touched on everything. Movies, music, design, architecture. Think Hawaiian or aloha shirts and leis. A fancy night out was a trip to the local tiki lounge. Backyard luaus were popular as people built their own home tiki bars, complete with tiki torches and mugs, and record players spinning Hawaiian music. By the time the Brady Bunch vacationed in Hawaii and faced the curse of the tiki idol, tiki bars and culture were a bona fide pop culture phenomenon.
Hey, this is my tiki. That's my tiki.
What is this tiki for that?
Oh, for goodness sake, take any tiki.
Let's face it, tiki bars are complicated. But one thing's for sure. Even though they're inspired by Pacific Islander cultures, it makes total sense that they were invented in Los Angeles, the city of movies and make-believe. A city that, in the 1930s, was growing into a melting pot of cultures as tiki bars started getting popular. This brings us back to the Tiki Tea in Los Angeles and its founder, Ray Buchan. Here's Ray's son, Mike.
My dad came here in 1930 from the Philippines. What he did is he started working at the Figaro Hotel downtown here. He was a bellhop. Then he got a job at the Beverly Hills Hotel. The manager told him, he says, you know, Ray, Prohibition's ending. We want to send you to bartending school. He went to bartending school, and then when he got out, Don Gunt was opening up Don the Beachcomber. So he applied there, and he hired him. And that's how he got into tropical drinks.
Well, that wasn't normal for Filipinos, was it, to have that kind of job?
Well, yeah,
or was
Filipinos
it?
Back in the 30s and 40s made tropical drinks. They were the ones that started. They all became waiters, bartenders, busboys, and they were the backbone of tropical drinks at that time.
Ray was part of the first big wave of Filipino immigrants to the U.S. Because of restricted immigration laws, Filipino immigrants at the time were mostly men. And, like other people of color, they faced a lot of racism. This was the generation of manongs, or uncles, who came to L.A. in search of the American dream, but had to settle for something completely different instead. Ray was one of these men, and despite the odds, he was able to find work in almost every famous tiki bar in L.A. These places hired a lot of Filipino workers to do everything from serve food to carve ice sculptures. But Ray was first and foremost a bartender. His drinks were so famous that he was able to open a tiki bar of his own, the Tiki Tea, in 1961. Ray served many Hollywood stars over the years, like an up-and-coming director named George Lucas. The famous cantina scene in Star Wars, where Han Solo shot first, was supposedly based on Ray's bar, the Tiki Tea, and Ray was the basis for the character Yoda.
The data must have been erased.
The tiki bar scene has changed a lot since Ray Buchan first started mixing drinks. He passed away in 1999, but his son, Mike Buchan, is continuing the family business.
Well, because my dad, you know, being Filipino, he made some of the drinks, you know, with Tagalog.
That's Tagalog, a Filipino dialect. Some of the drinks at the Tiki Tea have Tagalog names, and Ray also invented some of them, like the Bayanihan, a coconut pineapple drink whose name means togetherness. I like the Chief Lapu-Lapu, which is a citrus punch named after the first hero of the Philippines who resisted Spanish colonization and killed the Portuguese explorer Ferdinand Magellan. Basically, Lapu-Lapu was a pioneer, kind of like Ray Buchan and a lot of those first Filipinos in LA, the original tiki bartenders.
That was contributor Paola Mardo in a piece she produced for Long Distance, her podcast about the Filipino diaspora. Another version of the story aired on Honolulu's Civil Beats Offshore podcast in 2017. You can listen to the full story, which includes a deeper dive into tiki history and the appropriation of Pacific Islander culture, on Long Distance, now playing on any podcast platform and at longdistanceradio.com. Now we turn our attention to a different drinking culture. I'm talking about sake.
Ototo, the idea is, first and foremost, it's a sake bar. Sort of I'm thinking about it in my head, almost like a wine bar that serves sake, where I really want people to come in and be able to drink sake casually and have it be fun and accessible.
That's sommelier Courtney Kaplan. She and her husband, Chef Charles Namba, recently opened Ototo, a sake bar in Echo Park next door to their izakaya restaurant, Tsubaki. I wanted to talk with her about how she got into the sake business and how beginners can learn to appreciate the Japanese rice wine. Hi.
Hi.
So I'm always kind of fascinated by people's passion stories. Like for you, Japanese culture, how did you dive into it? And when did you become a sake head?
It's kind of a long and convoluted road to getting to sake for me, but I was going to college in New York, and randomly this guy who lived next to me on my freshman year dorm had spent a year abroad in Japan and used to bring all these Japanese fashion magazines back to the dorm to look at and practice reading Japanese on. And I really fell in love with the Japanese fashion. I thought they wore the coolest clothes and everybody was so hip. Senior year of college, I knew I wanted to spend some time abroad myself. So I thought I may as well go to Tokyo. And when I got to Japan, I just really sort of, it sounds like a cliche, but I really fell in love with everything. I ended up getting a job working in a restaurant there just to earn a little bit of extra cash. And it wasn't a sake restaurant. We served pre-bottled cocktails and made with like syrups and pre-made mixes, nothing fancy. But just sort of that izakaya culture and that sense of hospitality and community really stuck with me. So when I went back to New York to finish up college, I knew I wanted a job where honestly I could continue to practice speaking Japanese. I just didn't want to forget the language, and ended up at a sake bar in the East Village pretty much randomly with no qualifications whatsoever to be working there. But the manager at the time was a wonderful guy who had a ton of knowledge and was very generous with it and really started, sort of took me under his wing and taught me a lot about sake. We got to taste maybe, I think we had a 50 to 60 sakes by the glass. We got to taste all the time. My sake experiences up until that point had not been very impressive. And then to go to the sake bar and taste all these really interesting and beautifully made sakes was really kind of an eye-opening experience for me.
And the whole idea of well-made sake is just one more sort of spoke in the wheel that is extreme Japanese artisanship.
Absolutely. I mean, some of these breweries that we're working with have been in the same family for 25 plus generations. Some of them have been around since the 1500s. It really is this craft that is often passed down. and the level of attention to detail that needs to go into every step of the process to end up with a delicious final result is really impressive. It's kind of amazing sometimes that sake even gets made. It's such a challenging product. I met a brewer recently who told me he had an Italian guy who was spent a little time with him in his brewery in Japan because he wanted to go back to Italy and make sake. And after spending 2 weeks at the brewery and seeing what went into it, the guy turned to the brewer and said, "You know what? I think I'm just going to stick with wine. There is sake is out of my league."
Why? Tell us how it's made.
Oh, this is a tough question. So it's a long, complicated process, but essentially you're taking rice, and it's not table rice, it's sake rice that has a larger starchy center. You are polishing away the exterior husk, which is where a lot of the fats and proteins are, to get more of that starch. Then you're steaming the rice. You're then taking some of the rice and inoculating with it with koji, which is basically a fungus that turns the starch into sugar to help the fermentation happen. Then you're putting all of that together with more rice and water and yeast, and what happens then is called multiple parallel fermentation. So in the same tank, the yeast is turning the sugar to alcohol at the same time that the koji is turning more starch into sugar. And it's the only beverage in the world that's made this way, where two fermentations happening at the same time in the same tank.
And the variations come from different yeasts, different rices, how much you polish?
All of the above. There's many different varieties of sake rice that can be used. Recently, there's been more of an interest in using heirloom rice, which is very interesting. Most sake is made with selected yeast, so the brewers are choosing the yeast that they'd like to use to get their desired end result. The amount of polishing, the more you polish, the more, I would say, oftentimes elegant flavors you're getting, the cleaner flavors you're getting. If you leave more of the exterior on, can be a little more rustic, a little more rough around the edges. There's different ways of making that yeast starter that sometimes will involve a little bit of natural yeast where you get a little more game and smoke and earthiness into it. The question is then, do you pasteurize or do you not pasteurize the sake? Do you charcoal filter or do you not charcoal filter? There's a lot of different points in the process where brewers are making decisions to end up with the final result.
And the final result is divided into how many different categories? About?
That's also a difficult question, but we sort of think about sake on two different axes. There's junmai versus honjozo. Junmai just means pure rice, and that's sake that's just made from water, rice, and koji, whereas honjozo also has a little bit of alcohol added to it, some brewer's alcohol, a distilled spirit that helps to actually lighten the sake, which sounds a little counterintuitive.
That's so interesting. Does it pump up the alcohol level?
It doesn't, because they're diluting the sake, the end result, regardless. Most sake does get a little bit of water added to it at the very end to bring the alcohol down. So even the honjozo that has alcohol added will be a similar alcohol percentage. And then we also talk about junmai versus ginjo versus daiginjo, which has to do with how much the rice is polished. So those are sort of the two different ways that junmai sort of operates. And then we have yamahai and kimoto, which refer to these really more old-fashioned brewing methods.
So it's interesting. You've chosen to open Ototo directly next door to Tsubaki. So Tsubaki is this experience of exceptional izakaya food with spirits, with sake. Is Ototo meant to be sake with littler bites?
That's exactly it. Yeah, Ototo, the idea is, first and foremost, it's a sake bar. Sort of I'm thinking about it in my head, almost like a wine bar that serves sake, where I really want people to come in and be able to drink sake casually and have it be fun and accessible and not a stressful situation. But if they do want something to eat, we have a great menu of sort of bar drinking snacks available for it. In Japan, you're typically, when you're drinking, you are eating something. It's not often that you're just drinking on your own or drinking just alcohol by itself. So we, you know, having a menu seemed really appropriate, but it's definitely a smaller, more casual menu.
So give us an idea of what some of the menu items would be.
Something that we're really excited about is a dish called okonomiyaki, which translates to basically like cooked as you like it. It's a specialty of Osaka, and it's essentially a savory cabbage pancake. So we take a base dough of eggs and flour and a little bit of yamaimo, which is this mountain yam, and mix in some cabbage and some pickled ginger, and then griddle that. And then it gets topping, and then we can either mix in corn and cheese, or we're doing pork belly as another variation, and then it gets a little tonkatsu sauce and some kewpie mayo and some bonito flakes on top. It's just like, Osaka is a really big drinking and eating city, and it's just such a perfect accompaniment to drinking. It's hearty, and it's savory, and they're sweet, and it's really delicious.
So you know people are going to be coming just for the okonomiyaki.
I hope so.
Give us a couple of the under-the-radar producers that you're currently fangirling over.
One of my eternal favorites, and I hope she's not too under the radar at this point anymore, but it's a brewery called Fukucho, and they are in Hiroshima, and it's run by this amazing woman named Miho Imada. She is unusual for several reasons. First and foremost, she's a woman in the sake industry, which is not that common. Out of about, I believe, about 1,800 breweries in Japan, I think only 30-ish or so have a woman in charge. And not only is she does she own the brewery, but she's also the master brewer. So she does two roles, which is unusual for anybody of any gender to do. And she makes the most beautiful, elegant sake. Hiroshima has this really soft water that can be hard to brew with. And she makes this sake called Moon on the Water, which is a Junmai Ginjo that's just so aromatic and gentle and delicious with all different kinds of food. Every spring she releases an unpasteurized version that has so much energy and life. And it's just kind of tastes like springtime when you're drinking it. And she's really involved in reviving heirloom rice that's local to her region. She works closely with rice farmers. She just really is a pretty special person. And I try to always have something from her brewery on the list at any given time. Also lately have been really enjoying sake called Taka, which is from Yamaguchi in Western Japan. And the gentleman who makes that sake actually spent quite a bit of time in Burgundy. He was working in Chablis and spent some time with Philippe Pacolet as well. And he really became obsessed with limestone soil in Chablis. And when he went back to Japan, he found this limestone water source for his sake. And the sake that he makes, this Tokubetsu Junmai, has this beautiful minerality. And minerality is not something we often talk about with sake. To find a sake that really has it is just such a special thing. And it's this very kind of quiet and soft-spoken sake that's just so layered and complex and really can sort of take you on a journey through the glass.
Wow. I'm very excited for you. I know this has been a very long time coming, thanks to the Los Angeles Building Department. I wish you the best of luck.
Thank you so much.
That's Courtney Kaplan. We've been talking about Ototo, her new sake bar, with Charles Namba in Echo Park. LA Times food editor Peter Meehan recently called Ototo the best place to drink sake in America. On that note, Bill Addison recently visited what he calls a world-class Japanese restaurant. Recently won a Michelin star, and it's right here in LA. Stay with us for his review. It's after this break. Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. Now for a review from LA Times restaurant critic Bill Addison. He's joining me to talk about an extraordinary Japanese restaurant. Hi, Bill.
Good morning, Evan.
Where are we going?
We're going someplace really special. It's really hard to get into. I'm sorry, Los Angeles. But also worth the fight for a reservation. It is a 7-seat restaurant in downtown Los Angeles called Hayato.
At the Row DTLA.
Yes, at the Row DTLA complex.
In January 2018, we did a segment with Brandon about his bento boxes when he was still in the process of building out the restaurant, and I kind of figured that it was going to be this fabulous.
First of all, we should say the chef is Brandon Hayato Go. He's a native of Southern California. His father has run a sushi bar for many years. Brandon has cooked in Japan a lot and wanted to open something that sort of reflected what he had absorbed, both in his time growing up with his father cooking there and also in Japan.
So is he doing kaiseki?
It is inspired by kaiseki, which is a very ritualized, multi-course meal that evolved out of Japanese tea ceremonies. But Brandon sort of frowns on being called kaiseki. He would rather be called modern Japanese food.
And he's doing something unusual in that it's one seating only, right?
Yes, it is 7 seats.
Everybody sits at the same time.
At 7 p.m.
And everybody gets served.
All at once. And it's a show. Of course, there's day-long preparations, but the dishes are being composed in front of you, and Brandon hands them out, or his other chefs hand them out, and then he briefly explains them, and then while you're eating that course, he's moving on to preparing the next thing. It's about 12 courses in all.
Describe the suomono.
This is a bowl of dashi. It changes sometimes, but when I had it, it was this gorgeous steamed ball of Dungeness crab with a little Japanese parsley on top. It was sweet and minerally and tasted of the ocean.
At the end of the experience, are you so full that you're overwhelmed and you can't like reach back into each individual thing, or is it a truly singular experience?
I would say it's a truly singular experience, part of which is because, again, like kaiseki, every dish reflects a different cooking technique. So there are fried dishes, simmered dishes. This focuses on seafood. It ends often with king mackerel over rice, and it's presented in this beautiful pot. There's more than enough to go around, so the chefs are asking if you want seconds or thirds. They'll give you just a little bite of dessert after, but in a lot of ways, like the fish and rice course is the spiritual finale of the meal. I have been doing a lot of eating in my 6 months in Los Angeles so far, and this is absolutely the most special experience that I've had in a restaurant. It's not cheap. I think it's about $250 per person right now. But for a celebration, for something truly extraordinary, I would send you all to Hayato.
So you're going to send us all to Hayato. There's 7 seats. What are the chances that we're going to get in?
Okay. So what you have to do is jump on reservations a month before the day you want to go. They go live at midnight.
And so if you're a single, go by yourself.
Yeah, go by yourself.
Because that last seat
is often open. I have honestly looked in the last month. I've been following along, and sometimes I see one open seat that I could just jump on, and I'm tempted to do it.
Let's not air this part of this conversation.
Oh, I'm such a service journalist. Let's do it.
Thank you so much, Bill.
Thanks, Evan.
I've been talking with LA Times restaurant critic Bill Addison about the Michelin-starred Hayato at the Row DTLA. Visit the Good Food website for a link to his LA Times review. That's kcrw.com/goodfood. Finally, we close out our show with a visit to the Santa Monica Farmers Market. Here's Jillian Ferguson with the market report.
I'm here in Santa Monica with Max Dornbush. Max is the buyer for all of the Jelena restaurant group. That includes Jelena, Jelena Takeaway, Justa, and Mountain. So Max, I see you here at the market every week. You're filling up a huge truck with a bunch of produce. What does it mean to be a buyer for a restaurant group?
A lot of communication, mostly. A lot of back and forth between the chefs and the vendors, kind of having one foot in the restaurant, one foot in the kitchen, and one foot mostly on the farm. But as pertains to this interview, one foot on a boat as well. We work with a lot of vendors, an unusual amount for a restaurant group. We have a couple restaurants, obviously, so it's a lot of coordination and communication, really.
So here we are at Wild Local Seafood, one of the vendors that you buy from. What are you shopping for today?
Today we are shopping for halibut, mussels, and king salmon.
What is special about the king salmon that you like to get from Wild Local Seafood?
The king salmon we get all comes off of Captain Ben's boat. It's extremely fresh. It's really high quality. It's as direct and traceable as a seafood product, or really any product, gets. They're gorgeous fish.
Wow. So when we are at the market and we're looking for fish, can you give us a few tips on what we should be looking for to find the freshest possible seafood?
Sure. It's a little trickier for the consumer on the retail side as opposed to for me, because on the restaurant end, we always buy whole fish as a rule. With a few exceptions, we usually get to see the gills and the eyes. But in either case, you can tell just by touching the fish how firm it is, usually. Different species of fish will have a different, you know, firmness or softness depending on, you know, the muscle structure and the fat content. If you're getting it at Wild Local, you can usually ask them, when was this fish caught? And they'll be able to tell you where and when, whether it's fresh or towards the end of the season. They know everything about the product they're selling, so they're happy to tell you.
Yeah, which is one of the best things about being able to come right up to their stand and buy here at the market. And what about what you guys are doing with it at the restaurant? Are you using salmon at all of the Jelena restaurants?
GTA is not serving wild king salmon. Jelena, Mountain, and Justa all serve those. It doesn't work quite as well in like the takeaway format. And it's mainly pizza and sandwiches and salads and some breakfast items. But any place where we're serving an entree or where raw salmon would be appropriate, we try to take advantage of it as much as we can for as long as we can. At Jelena, it's used, for example, in preparation called tataki with horseradish and lemon zest. It gets briefly grilled over really high heat, some lemon juice and sea salt. It's really simple, but the magic is in the quality of the product and having a really, really intense wood-fed grill.
Mm-hmm. So if we don't have a wood-burning oven like you guys do at Jelena, what is the best way, do you think, to cook these fish at home?
I think the best way to enjoy it is not to overcook it. Don't cook it very much. Probably for most people, that means cooking it less than you think, less than you're used to, less than you'd expect. Wild king salmon is really best rare or medium rare.
Or raw.
Or raw, or not cooked at all. But when we're cooking it, we're always being mindful of, you know, giving it like either really high heat very briefly or carefully applying heat so that it doesn't go too far.
And what about if we want that really nice crispy skin?
Nice crispy skin, you'll want it scaled, and you'll want to use some kind of cooking fat and some heat for sure. So you can get that on a grill, a nice hot grill, and you can get that as well by searing in a pan. You'll probably want to score the skin just a little bit. Some light scoring will mean that when the skin hits your saute pan, which hopefully you've got nice and hot before you put the oil and shortly thereafter the fish, when the skin hits that, it naturally wants to curl as it cooks, and the scoring will allow it to stay flat with just a little bit of gentle pressure from a spatula, which means you get that nice, even crisp. I think that's a step that a lot of home cooks miss. Mm. And getting the pan hot enough.
Man, all this talk about salmon skin is making me hungry. Max, thank you so much.
Yeah, my pleasure.
That was Max Dornbush. He is the buyer for all of the Jelena restaurants. That includes Jelena, Giusta, Jelena Takeaway, and Mountain, most of which are on Abbot Kinney in Venice. I'm talking now with Molly Allison, who is one of the people here at the Santa Monica Market who sells for wild local seafood. Molly, what's going on with California salmon season this year?
The salmon season is actually off to a really good start. Typically, the season runs from May through October, and they determine that based on the number of returning adult king salmon that come back to the river systems. And based on the beginning of the season, the numbers are looking really good. So probably going to be a good year for the king salmon.
Yes, I've been seeing reports not only in the news but also on Captain Ben's Instagram that this has been like a really big year for California king salmon. What are the factors that lead to a really good year?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think just with the past seasons, you know, they determine how long the season is going to last and how much salmon people can catch based on how the population is doing. That is the result of accumulation of years where they are monitoring it very, very closely and making sure that people aren't overfishing. In addition, also, just how much rain we've been getting. I think this past season where we got more rain than we have been is definitely contributing as well.
Right, yeah, because the salmon spawn in the rivers before they are then caught at sea.
Yeah, and actually the drought has been a major problem for the salmon because a lot of those rivers either don't have water at all or the water that they do have is too warm in order for those juvenile salmon to make it out to sea.
Oh, wow. Okay. So talk to us a little bit about where you guys are fishing. I know we're fishing for California king salmon. Mm-hmm. What part of California are they being caught in?
Yeah. So the salmon, we catch them anywhere between as far south as Avila, which is where we're fishing for them now. So you start off further south in the beginning of the season. And then as the season moves on, we'll move further north up as far as Fort Bragg. So right now we're still in Avila.
Okay. And Captain Ben is out there on his boat. His boat is called the Always Grinding. Mm-hmm. And he is out there grinding it out, fishing for salmon. What do you hear from him?
It's not super often I'm able to talk to him because he's always, like, this time of the year is just wild. But last I talked to him, he sounded really, really happy with his first trip. So I think he's out there right now, actually.
Yeah. And how many days at a time does he stay out there on the boat?
Typically, I'd say averages about a week, but he doesn't really know when he goes out there. So if he goes out and he's just having a really hard time catching them, he might come back early. And if he's doing really well, then he might stay out a bit longer.
So Ben spends a week out at sea, then he comes and he offloads at the dock in Ventura, right?
So typically we'll actually have someone drive our truck up to meet him wherever he's been fishing. and then offload some of that salmon, and then we drive it down ourselves in our truck.
Okay, but then here at the market, we've got these beautiful fillets. So do you guys stop along the way and cut them all up and then bring them down here?
Yeah, so our cutting facility is in Ventura. So when Ben catches the fish, they stay whole and they're sitting on ice, and they're on ice all the way back to the shop. And then once we get them back to the shop, they stay whole and on ice up until the day before the market. And that's when we cut it up. Unless we're preparing for the off season, and that's towards the end of the season, then we will slice them in whole sides and freeze those sides whole.
So when people come up to your stand here at the market, there are a few different cuts of fish. How do you help people pick out what it is that they're looking for?
Typically, I will ask if they have a certain recipe in mind or if they prefer a certain cut, because the tail is generally not going to have any bones. However, it's not going to be quite as fatty, whereas the center pieces and pieces towards the collar are going to have more marbling. That white marbling there is actually the fats that you're looking at. Those are typically better for sashimi, or say if you want to throw something on the grill, it's nice to have a centerpiece that's a little more even across. That way you are able to cook it a little bit more evenly.
Mm-hmm. And what about the tail meat? What do you recommend people do with that?
It's just as good on the grill, or if you're going to bake it, or if you're going to throw it in a pan. But really, it's probably best, I think, when people are just concerned about the bones.
Wonderful. Thank you, Molly, so much.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
That was Molly Allison. She is one of the people who works for Wild Local Seafood. You can find Wild Local Seafood at the Wednesday Santa Monica Market, the Saturday Pico Santa Monica Market, Sunday Mar Vista, Sunday Hollywood, and Saturday Torrance Markets here in Los Angeles. For the Market Report, I'm Jillian Ferguson.
That's it for our show this week. If you missed any of it, listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. And as always, leave us a review if you like the show. Our thanks to Therese, Dana the Peasant Farmer, and Rosie Journalism for your recent reviews. It means a lot. My thanks to the Good Food team, Nick Liao, Laurel Garcia, Joel Stein, Joseph Stone, and Ronnie Mickelson. Special thanks to Amy Ta, Kenny Ng, Paola Mardo, and Laura Kondarajan. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with a brand new episode of Good Food.